Hello, everyone. Welcome to Better Health While Aging, a podcast that gives you strategies and information about improving the health and well-being of older adults. We discuss common health problems that affect people over age 60, the best ways to prevent and manage those problems, and we also often address common concerns and dilemmas that come up with aging parents and other older loved ones, like what to do if you're worried about falls or safety or memory or even the quality of an older person's healthcare. I'm your host, Dr. Leslie Kernison. I'm a practicing geriatrician, so that means I'm a medical doctor specialized in geriatrics, which is the art and science of modifying healthcare so that it works better for older people and for their families. For today's episode, I'm going to do something different because this week it became clear that we are embarking on very different times because of the rapidly evolving coronavirus situation in the United States. I actually had another podcast episode ready to publish this week, a really terrific interview, but I've decided to postpone releasing that in order to use the podcast to share with you a lecture and Q&A session that I just did yesterday on Thursday, March 12th for people who are in our Helping Older Parents membership program. So as you may know, about a year ago, I launched an ongoing online membership program to support people navigating the journey of helping a declining aging parent. And as part of that program, I do live group question and answer calls with our members twice a month. And as part of the program, members also get access to a Helping Older Parents course that I developed. So usually during our group calls, I don't prepare a lecture. Instead, I answer whatever the members want to ask me about, and we often discuss some of their difficult situations. However, with the coronavirus really emerging as a major public health crisis over the past week, our members had a lot of questions about how this could affect them, and especially their frail aging parents. And they had questions that I'm not quite seeing answered in the media right now. So I decided to prepare a short talk that would cover not only the basics of the coronavirus situation, but also highlight some specific considerations related to frail older adults during this time. And then I also answered member questions. And I decided to share the audio from our session on the podcast. I did let the members know that I would be doing this. None of them are going to be identified by full name. But I want to do that because in this time of health crisis, I feel very strongly about trying to be of service to as many older adults and families as possible. And I want to say right up front that along with the basics about coronavirus, the precautions, you should all be hearing from your local public health department right now about precautions and the situation to know in your area. But I feel this is also a really important time for older adults and families to have reviewed advanced care planning, because falling ill from coronavirus is definitely a situation that can cause an older person to become extremely ill. Of course, I'm hoping that this will not happen to too many older people, but it is a possibility, and older adults are at particular risk of becoming extremely ill and unable to make healthcare decisions. So in this session, I do cover advanced planning specifically in the context of coronavirus. I hope you will find this session and listening to the member questions helpful. If you have questions after listening, you can post them in the comments for the episode page. As you know, I am not particularly an expert in infectious diseases or coronavirus, so this isn't meant to be a comprehensive of everything you need to know, but it is my perspective on what's most important to know right now and how to apply it for older adults and for people helping older parents and other frail older relatives. So I hope this will help. Take care. Hello again, everyone. This is Dr. Leslie Kernison of Better Health While Aging and the Helping Older Parents membership. Welcome to today's group coaching and Q&A call. Today is Thursday, March 12th, and so we do have a special theme today, which is that I am going to do some teaching related to the coronavirus. Several of you posted questions for me related to that, and so I thought I will do a quick little lesson with what I've learned about it so far, and then we will go into your specific questions. With no further ado, I don't even have any membership updates for the time being. We're just going to go into coronavirus. And actually, before I do that, very quickly, is there anyone on the call who had a question who has a time constraint and has to leave early? If you do, let me know. And also, if you would like to ask a question, I have a bunch of questions that you guys posted in the group. But oh, who raised their hand? Someone seemed to have raised their hand. I couldn't tell. All right. Okay. Well, let me know in the chat if you have to go early and you want me to do your question sooner. And also, if you want to ask a question and you didn't send it in ahead of time, post it in the Q&A box. All right. Coronavirus. Now, this has been in the news a lot, so I expect you all know the basics. So I'm just going to zoom through some of the basics and then focus on some of the issues that I think are really relevant to older adults who might be frail, like many of your parents. So again, this originated in Wuhan, China. They first became aware of it probably in December. It became kind of new international news in January, and then the first case in the United States was reported on January 21st in Washington State. So it has not even been 2 months, and now we are kind of the count varies depending on where you look, but according to the New York Times, which is trying to compile it in many different places, over 1,300 cases in 44 states and 38 deaths. And what's really important to bear in mind is that many areas are experiencing what's called community transmission, meaning that it's not just people who have come back from China or have been in contact with somebody who traveled at one of the areas. There's now also a quite large outbreak in Italy and in Iran. They actually have it in most countries in Europe at this point. So they're actually seeing it, people have it who have just not been exposed to anyone from overseas. So that's why they call it community transmission. We definitely have it here in the Bay Area. Then the biggest hotspots are right now Seattle, New York City, the Bay Area, and Boston. So this is a situation that is changing very, very quickly. And so this is a quote that I saw in the newspaper today, again, the New York Times. South Dakota, which on Tuesday morning had no known cases, had eight by Wednesday night, including a death. So it's evolving very quickly. So that means things, certainly the statistics that I share with you today might be outdated, within 3 days. But I think the general concepts and principles are going to stand for a while. So one of them is that these are relatively uncharted waters, right? So if you are wondering just how at risk your older parent is, what your, local hospital is going to do, how your local public health department is going to handle it, they are all learning about this as they go. And in terms of what to expect, in terms of the clinical illness people might have, the risks they might have, they're figuring that out as they go. Now, they do have some data from China that was published in the New England Journal of Medicine. They have another report in the Journal of American Medicine. We still don't know like how relevant the experience in China is going to be for us predicting how sick people should get. For most healthcare providers and hospitals, this is new and novel, although some of them have, done epidemic preparation in the past. And then at the Center for Disease Control and also at many public health schools in the country, at Harvard, Berkeley, at other ones, they do have infectious disease experts who specialize in these kinds of epidemics, who have often gone and worked on past ones, like the SARS one in China. Several years ago. So they are leveraging some of that expertise in terms of what worked in those past ones, and we are increasingly turning to them for guidance. So in terms of what happens when people get coronavirus, so as you've probably heard, it's a virus. It is not the influenza virus, but it generally causes symptoms that are very similar to influenza. And it's pretty variable. Some people might just be mildly ill. Some people get something that feels, kind of like the flu, an upper respiratory viral infection, sore throat, fever, cough. But the thing that we worry about is when it causes viral pneumonia, which it does For some people, I think I have it on an upcoming slide. You know, maybe it's like 20% of people who are getting pneumonia overall. And when that viral pneumonia gets severe, it causes what we call respiratory failure. So pneumonia means an infection in your lung, and because your lungs are there to bring oxygen into your blood, right? If your lungs are gunky and unwell, they cannot manage that transportation of oxygen from the air you're breathing in into your bloodstream, and you become short of breath. That's why people with pneumonia are often coughing and having shortness of breath. And if that shortness of breath gets bad enough, then it results in what we call respiratory failure, which means that your lungs basically cannot keep up with bringing your body the oxygen that it needs. What we do right now in modern medicine is, first we give people, oxygen in their nose. That helps a little bit, but really, if somebody is having respiratory failure, you have to do what's called, mechanical ventilation. They can put a close-fitting mask on and just force in more air. But what they really need to do is put a tube in people's throats and start to ventilate them with what's called a ventilator. So a breathing machine, a machine that breathes for the person. The thing is that a ventilator helps when people are having respiratory failure, but at the same time, if the lungs are bad enough, the ventilator may not be able to do enough to compensate. So especially if the infection is quite significant, that is sometimes called acute respiratory distress syndrome, the person can still die. The other thing, and actually one of my friends who's an emergency medicine doctor, like, forwarded me an email, which seems to be something written by one of the critical care doctors in Seattle describing their experience that's getting like passed around, among doctors. But they were saying that not only are they seeing people experience overwhelming lung failure that the ventilator cannot compensate for, but that they're also seeing other organs being affected and fail, especially the heart. It looks like some patients are getting a what we would call a viral cardiomyopathy. That is causing, the heart to stop or to start fibrillating, and then, they'll attempt a resuscitation and they're often not able to be successful. It also looks like some other organs are being affected, like the liver. Now, in terms of mild disease, some people also do get some diarrhea. It's not clear right now how much transmission happens related to what we would call fecal-oral contamination. So again, like all the statistics are being hastily gathered up, so they have to, be taken, considered an estimate that could be corrected quite significantly as we learn more. But right now, the mortality rate for people who are sick enough to require critical care, depending on who's reporting it, has been anywhere from 22% to 62%. I think it was 49% in one of the reports published in the Journal of American Medicine a few weeks ago. And right now, there is no confirmed antiviral treatment. So for influenza, we do have some antiviral drugs that are effective specifically against influenza and can help when people are sick from influenza. But right now, we don't have anything confirmed for this virus. This virus is new. So what's happening in some hospitals is that they're trying a few antivirals. It's not clear which, if any, are working. They're certainly like hard at work, on another front trying to study this and develop something. That's going to take a while before it's confirmed. So the treatment right now is what we call supportive treatment for pneumonia and for organ failure, basically. So it starts off with IV fluids and oxygen. And then when people are critically ill, it turns into, what we call life support, which is basically the ventilator breathing for you. When people are very sick, they often need special medication to maintain their blood pressure. Those are called pressors. Some people go into kidney failure and need some dialysis. They try to support the heart as best they can, and they try to basically support the person and give it time while the person's body fights back the infection if they're able to. So that's what happens when people get very sick from this. And they are also working on a vaccine, but it's estimated that it would take at least 18 months. So Spectrum of illness, as I mentioned, and you've probably again heard this in the news, it looks like a lot of people who catch the coronavirus, looks like some people have no symptoms. And then it looks like a lot of people have, what's called mild. And I think mild, actually, you probably also saw it in the news. Tom Hanks, the actor, reported that he has tested positive for coronavirus. And I don't know if you saw, but the way he describes his illness, was like, I had some body aches. I felt kind of blah, like I had a cold, but my wife had some fevers. So for him, it didn't even sound like what I would, think of as when people are really sick from the flu, which is, a very high fever, a terrible sore throat, feeling like they were run over by a truck. So that, there's clearly a spectrum of what people are going to experience. And children in particular have, I don't think there have been any deaths reported in children under age 10. And children, if they get sick, it seems to be very, very mild. But when they say mild, it's anything from that, like, it's kind of like a cold or maybe a bad cold to I was sick in bed with a fever and a sore throat for a few days. But right here, we could consider mild, whatever doesn't require hospital care. And many people who are coming to emergency rooms or hospitals are being, told to go home and kind of monitor themselves at home. But right now, the estimate is that about 14 to 15% of people are hospital level ill. So that means that they're either really having trouble breathing, or they may have other chronic illnesses that puts them at such high risk that they're put in the hospital so that you can give them that extra support if they need it. And then about 6%, sometimes they say up to 8%, are critically ill. So who is at high risk? It looks like it's similar to influenza, which is older adults, people who are immune compromised, and then people who have a lot of chronic illnesses, especially the ones that either affect the immune system or that affect your heart and lungs. So the mortality rate overall has been estimated at between 1 to 4%. So for comparison, the seasonal flu is 0.1%, so that's 1 in 1,000. We still have thousands of people die of the flu every year, tens of thousands actually, because we have millions of people who get the flu. But so they're thinking that this one is a higher mortality rate than the seasonal flu. But in China, the rate for people who are over age 80 was almost 15%. Also, I haven't seen the media make a big deal of it, but in Italy, where they have an outbreak, I count the numbers. And I think I saw, today that it was 15,000 infections and 1,000 deaths. That's a mortality rate of over 6%, which is high. And I'm not, I haven't yet read more about the hypothesis for why it's so high over there. So this is data from China, the Chinese CDC, that I then found in Business Insider. But some of my doctor friends said they had seen this graph too. So you can see that the mortality rate really goes up as people get older. So we have it less than 1% in people who are under age 50. People in their 50s, 1.3%. People in their 60s, 3.6%. People in their 70s, 8%. And people who are age 80 plus at 15%. And again, this is the series in China. It is too early for us to have this data for the United States. And then you've also probably heard how in Seattle, Washington, that is a hotspot, and they in particular had an outbreak at a nursing home. I think the name is Life Care. So I keep seeing variable numbers for how many people have died and how many residents they had. What I found today looked like maybe 18 deaths out of 110 residents, and at least another 30 infections among the residents. A significant number of the staff at the nursing home have been either symptomatically ill or quarantining themselves. They've had a shortage of testing kits. That's been a persisting problem these past few weeks in the United States. So not all the workers there have been tested. And in interviews, the spokesperson for the nursing home said that some people became ill very quickly and sort of within an hour or two went from, being like, oh, I'm not sure I feel great, to being so sick that they were sent to the hospital. So this is definitely very concerning. But also, again, there seem to be several residents who have the infection and who are not in the hospital. So we want to be mindful that a 15% mortality rate or 20%, 1 in 5, is considered super high in modern times. At the same time, it means that most, even among those people who are 80 plus, it means that 80% of them are surviving it. So how does it spread? So this too, I'm sure you've heard in the news ad nauseum, but it's thought to be similar to influenza in that it's especially what's called respiratory droplets. So when you cough or sneeze, you spray out little drops that contain virus. You are spraying some of them out also when you talk, just less. Breathing that in is thought to be especially bad when it sort of settles into the passage, the mucous membranes of your nose or possibly the back of your throat. That's when the virus really has a chance to dig in and get started with you. And then again, how sick you're going to get from that is going to depend on your immune system and just like the particulars of your genetics. But it's also possible, you know, when people cough or sneeze or rub their nose, they put their respiratory, we call them secretions, on their hands, and then they touch things that other people tend to touch. So especially doorknobs, right? Or if you think about it, as you go through public spaces, we're often touching things that other people have touched with their hands. So it's especially hard surfaces that you want to think about. Again, I don't think there's enough data for this particular virus, but I know when they've studied influenza doesn't live very long on soft surfaces like Kleenexes and bed sheets. It's really on harder surfaces that it can survive for hours, possibly even days. I saw a preliminary study where they said that the coronavirus had survived on some hard, I think it was plastic and metal surfaces for up to 3 days. You know, again, all these studies are coming out in a rush and they aren't peer reviewed. So you have to like take them with a grain of salt. But you want to especially think about hard surfaces as being a risk, because if someone has contaminated a hard surface and then you touch that with your hand and then you touch your face, and it is extremely easy to touch your face if you're not paying attention, especially your nose or your eyes, then you can get the virus. So what we don't know, what there's been a lot of debate over, is to what extent children might be spreading the virus, or people who are otherwise minimally symptomatic. So that's where there's been a lot of debate about whether or not to close schools so far. So the general prevention recommendations are that if you're serious about preventing it, you want to keep 3 to 6 feet away from other people, especially if they seem to be sick. You want to be washing your hands often. You want to avoid touching your face. You want to clean hard surfaces often with disinfectant. Also, you know, with hand washing, you're supposed to do like a very thorough 30-second, like, you know, more thoroughly than people usually do. Especially if you're high risk, you want to minimize travel, because travel tends to put people in very close proximity to each other. Travel is also a stressor on the body. It's tiring. And whenever your body is going to be tired, it's going to be more susceptible to catching an infection or having an infection get worse. So especially if you're high risk, you're supposed to minimize travel and crowds. Now, what is not recommended is masks. There has, you know, been a run on masks. You've probably heard there's a shortage of them, and it's actually turning into a problem for hospitals and facilities. So for now, masks are recommended for health providers, or if you have actually been diagnosed and you want to reduce the chance of transmitting to other people, a mask is recommended. But masks are not recommended right now for the general public for prevention. But what is increasingly recommended, especially in communities that seem to have transmission going on, is what they're calling social distancing. Which means reducing opportunities for people to be close to others. And so that means they are canceling events. Here in California, I think the governor just said that we should, you know, not have any events that involve more than 250 people. Prior to that, the San Francisco mayor said nothing with more than 1,000. So more and more employers are recommending that people work from home if it's, you know, possible and feasible. And again, some schools have been closed. And then we've had some particular problems in the United States so far. The issues that have come up for us so far as a country, and again, this is all extremely new. One huge problem is that there's been a shortage of tests. So many localities are reporting that they are having difficulty obtaining tests, and there are more people who want or need tests than they are able to do. So that's why probably the number of cases we have in the country is an underestimate. Here in San Francisco, my husband is a school teacher. His school was closed abruptly Thursday afternoon because a student's parent had tested positive. And then it was supposed to be closed just Friday, but then it was closed on Monday and Tuesday. And the rumor I heard is because it just took such a long time to get the student tested. They wanted to know if the student was positive in order to make a decision about whether to continue keeping the school closed or not. So that has definitely been an issue. And again, those workers at that nursing home in Seattle, reportedly many of them have still not been able to be tested because of a shortage of tests. There's been unclear guidance about who should quarantine themselves in terms of, self-quarantining, how much contact with someone who may or may not have it would warrant it. A lot of workers in our country are lacking paid sick leave. So that's been another issue. And then, depending on the area, there's been some reluctance to push for social distancing due to economic considerations. So you've also probably all heard the stock market is plunging. The airline industry is grave problem right now because so many people are canceling flights. Let's not even go into the cruise industry. I think so far the authorities, have not been super explicit about older adults should not take flights. They're kind of saying, I think the latest I heard was don't take long flights. So I would say it's a good idea to avoid, flights in general if you're high risk, because right now when you sit on a plane, you sit right next to somebody, right? So I want to talk briefly about the current public health focus. I think it's important for you all to understand it. So initially the focus here was identifying who has it, tracing who did they come in contact with, quarantine all those people, and kind of, keep it from spreading throughout the United States. Several epidemic experts, infectious disease experts, are saying that we're probably getting to the point where that's no longer going to be feasible. I mean, you can still try to slow it down somewhat, but the problem is that that's extremely labor intensive for public health departments to find a case and trace all the contacts, and they're getting overwhelmed doing it. They're overwhelmed doing it in a city like New York. So what I think we're seeing, and what I've heard some experts say, is that we're shifting towards slowing the spread of disease through social distancing. So it's not stopping the spread, it's slowing it down. So that one, fewer people get it, and also so that we have fewer people getting it quickly. So there was an interesting story, maybe it was in the Times too, about Evergreen Hospital. That's the hospital in Washington State that's near that nursing home. I mean, they got overwhelmed with cases, and they actually found that they had to bring people back to work from the quarantine, right? So initially it was you came in contact with that patient who had coronavirus, go quarantine yourself for 14 days. And then after a while, they were this is not sustainable because we have no workers, right? So unless people seemed sick, they had to bring some of them back because they needed the manpower. So, that's a little bit where we're going to. So the goal has increasingly become to flatten the curve. So how many people here have heard this term, flatten the curve? Anyone? You can tell me in the chat. Who's heard the term flatten the curve? I'm trying to figure out if this is a nerdy public health thing or if everybody knows about it already. Nobody is saying yes. All right. Okay, well, I will show you. Yeah, Mary said she's heard it. Okay. It's hot on Twitter. I haven't been on Twitter for years, but I've come back to it because my friend, who's an infectious disease doctor working on this, was you should follow this Harvard infectious disease doc on Twitter. He has the best latest thing. Right. So this is the flatten the curve thing. I cribbed this from the New York Times, which had adapted it from the CDC and The Economist. If coronavirus or an epidemic spreads quickly, you have the red curve. You have a spike fairly quickly, and then it comes down fairly quickly. And the problem is that your healthcare system has a certain capacity. And actually, US hospitals tend to run fairly close to full because that's what's cost effective, right? So they don't have a ton of extra intensive care unit beds. As is in places that have people concerned about coronavirus, the hotspots, they're putting off elective surgeries and things like that. So if it spreads quickly, you get this surge and you can overwhelm your healthcare system. And that's just bad in many, many ways. Whereas if you slow the spread, you might still end up with almost the same number of people who get it, but it's spread out over time. And you hopefully don't have any point in time when you are like overwhelming your healthcare system's ability to take care of people who are gravely ill. So that is where we are going right now. So some of you have asked in the group, how long is this going to go on? And the answer is we don't know, but it is partly related to this question of whether we are going to be successful in flattening the curve or not. And if we do flatten the curve, that is going to help, but it also means that we might be living with the threat of coronavirus for longer. Oh, Dr. Nicole, you're here. Good. I can have you on in a bit too. So what about advice specific to older adults? So the general advice is, take this seriously, but don't panic for everybody. And so for older adults, you want to be careful. You want to minimize travel and your exposures, especially if your community is affected. And actually, in the group and in the replay notes, some of you mentioned in the group, ARP had a call-in session with three experts on Tuesday. I didn't listen live, but they have a transcript available online, and I think that can be fairly helpful. They are just kind of public healthy experts. They're not particularly geriatricians. So one of the experts who was on that call was, what's her name? Seema Verna, I think. She is the head administrator for Medicare and Medicaid. So she sounded quite positive, at least in the transcript, and was saying, oh, well, the great thing is Medicare covers tests, so you won't have to pay for that. And Medicare covers telehealth. So this can be a safer, better way to get your health care, whether you're worried you're sick from coronavirus or you just need the rest of your health care. You can do telehealth with your providers because they can bill for it and be paid for it. So I think that sounds great. I mean, I think the question will be how available will you and your families find this to be to you? So for instance, right now we know there's a shortage of tests, right? So once tests are available, you won't have to pay for them, but we still need them to be more widely available. And then in terms of telehealth, that is really going to be a question of whether various clinics and providers are already equipped to provide telehealth. And I think we have to be mindful that especially if there does seem to be a coronavirus going around in a community, the healthcare providers are likely to be busier than usual. That doesn't mean that they won't be able to set up telehealth if they don't have it. It's just an additional challenge to be mindful of. But certainly you could ask your providers if they are equipped to provide any telehealth. Even phone triage, is going to be helpful. And then also for older adults, so CMS, that's the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, they have issued guidance this week for nursing homes, also for hospices, regarding coronavirus and infection control and how to manage, suspected cases or known cases. So rest assured, they are all on high alert. They are taking extra care regarding sanitation. And then some of them are limiting visitors and imposing other forms of social distancing. So what about frail older adults? And some of you brought up these questions in the group, and I haven't yet seen a lot about this in the news, but I think this brings up issues for us, right? As people who are concerned about frailer older adults, you taking care of your older parents, and me because this is my work. What happens, first of all, if usual caregivers, whether that's a paid caregiver or a family member, become sick or even is exposed, right? That's why it's going to become really important for us to get clearer guidance from the public health authorities, whether those are your local authorities or the national ones, on, like if you were in a room with somebody who later says, I was diagnosed with coronavirus, and you're somebody who works at a nursing home or is paid to go to an older person's house and help them, like, can you still go to work? What, how do you know when you're supposed to stay home for a while or not? And I think we don't entirely have answers to that yet. Now, certainly if somebody feels sick, they should not work, they should not come near people, other people in general, and certainly not near frail people who are vulnerable. But of course, if you are that frail older person, depending on the caregiver, or if it's, you concerned about your aging parent, like who is going to fill in, right? And I think we, you know, right now don't really know what to tell people other than it would be a good idea to have a backup plan, right? Another question that has come up is how bad is the social isolation going to become and how can we compensate? So when residential facilities, whether that's independent living or assisted living, or especially nursing homes, where people tend to be very limited in their way to get out on their own, you know, if they stop activities, if they stop sort of people eating together, then if they limit visits, right, it becomes a real serious quality of life issue for those older adults. And of course, social isolation in, you know, the long run is not good for health either. So, how bad is that going to become? And like, what might we do to compensate or mitigate it? So if you are one of our members who has an older relative who is in assisted living or in a nursing home, you know, what can or should you be doing to support them there or to help them be safer? And, you know, when we go through the Q&A session, I want to address some of your specific questions that some of you asked about this. And then what I think this is a very relevant time to think about is, you know, what if your relative does get coronavirus? So by coincidence, in the Helping Older Parents course follow along last weekend, it was module 7, which was about advanced planning and also end of life care. So this is a really timely moment to think about this. And so I have a few slides about this right now. So I want to come back to what is advanced care planning. Now, I find that people often tend to conflate it with like, it's about having told somebody exactly what you want when it's the end of life, which is basically like pull the plug or not, right? But I want to encourage you to again think about it more broadly. So first of all, end of life situations are very easy to recognize in hindsight. Hindsight is 20/20. What is less easy is to recognize ahead of time what might become a situation that could end up being an end of life situation. So, you know, very broadly speaking, and these are slides that I took from the lesson in module 7, but I think of it as learning about the types of decisions that might need to be made. And those aren't even necessarily going to be medical, right? So for you, they're also like, what if my parent needs more care, right? You know, could they stay in this house? But so it's, you know, what are the decisions that might need to be made? Considering them ahead of time, letting others know about the preferences. That's assuming the older person is able to take a really active role in this, often by putting it in an advance directive. So what should it address? So, you know, one important goal is to provide guidance on what the surrogate healthcare decision maker and the healthcare provider should do if there is a serious health crisis or emergency, if there are potential end-of-life situations. So again, I'm telling you, it's often not easy to tell ahead of time what is an end-of-life situation, but you know, we as geriatricians and other health providers can certainly tell you what's a very risky situation. And you want to cover like the preferences regarding use of life support. You want to have a sense of what would be this older person's preferred place to die and the general sort of idea of how aggressive you are probably going to want the life prolonging care to be. And so this relates to the POLST and how in general in medicine, you know, we often organize ourselves around three levels of care intensity. There's like full intensity, there's selective, and there's comfort focused. And let me see, I have them coming up. Here, I'll go into those in just a moment. So, for coronavirus, I don't want anybody to be too worried, and we have to balance. This is, I think, a time where it's useful to plan for the worst and hope for the best, or plan for things that are quite likely and quite possible, even though it's difficult and uncomfortable, and then we're going to hope for the best and hope that those plans are not necessary. And that's part of what the public health people are doing. A lot of what they project are worst case scenarios. And it's important for us to prepare so that we could handle it if it happened, you know, as a society. And hopefully it won't, okay? So for frail older adults, getting coronavirus probably would qualify as a serious health crisis or an emergency, certainly if they get sick enough to be noticeably sick, okay? And that can turn into an end-of-life situation. So this is a timely moment in these coming weeks to give some thought about, do you have a sense of whether your parent would want life support or whether your family is going to say yes or no to it, right? Because if your parent is sick, the health providers are going to be looking to you to provide that guidance. And depending on where you are and what kind of paperwork you already have, they might just forge ahead with it unless you speak up and make your preferences clear, or they might ask you. Again, it's going to depend on that clinic. It might, I mean, you know, my friends told me that here in San Francisco, they've had meetings with the critical care team where if they had too many people who needed ventilators, you know, how would they choose among them, right? So we don't know right now what the situation is going to be like if there is a surge of infections in certain areas, right? And if certain hospitals become overwhelmed. But you can still be asking yourself these questions of, you know, does my family have a sense of whether my parent would want life support or not? Do we have a sense of what would be their preferred place to die if there's a choice, which there may or may not be? And do we have a preference regarding the aggressiveness of care that is a good fit for them right now? So how many people here know, who here doesn't know what Pulst is? I cover Pulst in the course and we've mentioned it in the membership, physician orders for life-sustaining care. In some states it's called MOLST, which is actually a better name, medical orders for life-sustaining care, less doctor-centric. Who here, tell me in the chat if people know it or don't know it. Right now, nobody is like saying either way. Never heard of it. Okay. All right. Don't remember. Okay. Kim, I know it intimately. All right. So we'll post more resources about it in the group. But I do cover it in module 7 in both lessons. So Pulst is an idea that started in Oregon quite a while back. It's a state-by-state initiative. Right now, most states have it, but not all. But the idea was to take people's preferences regarding the care they would want in an emergency and turn it into some guidance and, you know, technically orders, physician orders or medical orders to guide paramedics and emergency room personnel. So this is California's Pulst form. Now, I will share an article with you in the group that I wrote on Better Health While Aging. This is not something that older adults or families should be filling out by themselves. It is supposed to be completed by a health provider after having a thoughtful conversation about advanced care planning and about goals of care, and also after making sure that the older person and their family have a good understanding of the older person's health state and what to expect. So that's a general idea in advanced care planning is people can't plan appropriately unless they have a realistic understanding of what kind of crises and declines to expect. So ideally, after you've had those conversations, it's kind of considered. So if this older person, you know, part A, were found down, had no pulse, were not breathing, would they want people around them to attempt resuscitation CPR? Or would they want do not attempt resuscitation, which can also be considered allow natural death? And the next section, and this gets at the intensity of care, is if the person is found with a pulse or is breathing, but they're feeling quite sick, would they generally prefer to get full treatment where the primary goal is prolonging life by all medically effective means, and that might include intubation, mechanical ventilation, cardioversion, so that's the shock that's often done as part of CPR. And in California, we have a little box where people can say, well, I would take a trial period, right? So don't keep me on it, life support forever, but, you know, maybe for a few days to see if I'm likely to get better. The next option is selective treatment, where the goal is to treat medical conditions while avoiding burdensome measures. So this usually includes IV antibiotics, IV fluids. In California, it says do not intubate. May use non-invasive positive airway pressure. That's the mask I was telling you, the close-fitting mask that kind of forces air into your lungs. Generally avoid intensive care. And in California, we have a box where people can say, request transfer to hospital only if comfort needs cannot be met in current location. So, and then the last one is comfort-focused treatment, where the primary goal is maximizing comfort. So you relieve pain and suffering with medication, you use oxygen if it seems helpful. But you avoid, you know, IV antibiotics, IV fluids. You don't send people to the hospital unless there's no other way to keep them comfortable. So the idea is that this is supposed to be sort of a shorter distillation of what might be in somebody's advanced directive, and that it's designed to provide guidance for like some very specific situations that come up for patients and families and health providers, which is, you know, generally, what kind of care do you want if this person gets quite sick? And you have to decide whether or not to send them to the hospital. So, for frail older adults, many of them, after a conversation with them and their families and an understanding of their state of health, so people who are frail and older, most of them generally won't are unlikely to do well with full treatment with intensive care if that's necessary. That's basically it. So often, older adults and families end up, we end up concluding that the second option, selective treatment, is in line with their goals and values and their medical situation. That's not true for everybody. I mean, some people will, even when they understand that their health situation is really tenuous, they're really unlikely to do well with intensive care, they still want it. That's their values, those are their preferences, and that's fine. The idea is to help people make an informed decision. But many of my frail older patients end up, for a phase of time being with the second option, selective treatment. Some of them have said they really don't want to go to the hospital unless it's necessary, and some of them don't mind going to the hospital, right? Again, it's partly a preference question. So those are the three levels of care. So to come back to coronavirus, right? If your older parent, God forbid, gets coronavirus and starts feeling quite short of breath, if you haven't thought about it before, then probably they will be taken to the hospital. And then again, you may or may not be asked whether they should get intensive care and intubation if their breathing continues to get worse. So I think as this coronavirus situation, spreads and emerges in the United States, it's really important to have considered, have you, do you have, first of all, in your state, is there something like Pulsed? But even if there isn't, asking, yourself the question, do I have a sense of what my parent would choose if they were able to choose? If your parent is able to discuss this with you, that's obviously ideal, but I know many of you have parents who are cognitively impaired or otherwise well, unwell. And in the group, we can talk more about exactly like how to discuss this, or we can talk about that during the Q&A session. Because if your parent gets coronavirus, then they might get quite ill and require hospitalization, and that could easily turn into intensive care. And they will also probably have to have all these isolation contact precautions, which means that everybody will be gowned up and you won't be able to be. I actually don't know right now how close they're allowing families to be. So, that's something to think about. So, we can talk more about that in the Q&A session. Last but definitely not least, I think right now is a really important time to not just think about your parents, but think about you. What about your self-care as coronavirus spreads? Because I'm going to tell you, your risk for these kinds of viral infections is totally affected by your underlying state of health and your stress and how tired you are. So, what I want to urge you to think about is commit to getting enough rest. If you haven't already done so, this is a time when it's important. I think getting exercise is also a good idea, and I want to suggest walks outside with friends or just walks outside. I mean, if you can go to the do full-on exercise. Of course, people are now a little bit skeevy about the gym, right? Are you going to get exposed to something in the gym? But being outside is probably fairly safe. Fortunately, it's the spring, the weather's going to get better and better. With friends is a way to socialize without getting super close to people the way you might be at a restaurant. I know many people, many of you, even before this came up, were chronically quite stressed, understandably. You're juggling a lot with your parents and with the rest of your lives. So if you haven't tried them, I want to again make a pitch for something like our Helping Older Parents self-care audios or something else that is relaxation oriented. And we have had some members who use them who say that it helps them fall asleep. It does work better if you do it regularly. So if you've been feeling very stressed out and you're like, sleep, I'm already having trouble sleeping. I want to encourage you to look into these kinds of relaxation audios and see if you can get more sleep and rest, because that is going to make a big difference in your resistance to this virus. I want to caution you against attempting to do everything for your parents or others during this time. Yes, we want to step up and help when a crisis hits. And some of you might opt to spend more time helping your parents right now to to prevent them from going out and running their own errands and getting exposed. That's fine. But I just want to remind you that, again, you don't have to do everything. And just be careful about it, because I do want you to balance their well-being with your well-being. Yours is important, again, because you need to be in this for the long game. So you're going to only be able to do what you can do, and that is partly going to be related to what happens with the healthcare system around us. A lot of stuff right now is going to be out of our control. And then, as we'll talk about in the Q&A session, you know, some of you have parents who are forgetful, who are not going to remember to wash their hands and do these things, and we're going to have to encourage people and still do the best that we can. So, in summary, we're in the midst of an unprecedented public health emergency in the United States. Frail older adults are at especially high risk. It's too soon to know how long this will go on. It's too soon to say exactly what the risk is for any particular individual. I think it is valuable to consider social distancing, both for yourself personally, but especially for your older parents, especially if there's community transmission going on around you. I would say now is a good time to cancel any non-essential travel. And then I want to encourage you, if you haven't already done so, to think about goals of care and your parents' priorities. And that's not just to sort of like have thought ahead, like if my parent got really sick from coronavirus, you know, do we as a family have a sense of what intensity of care we would want, where they would prefer to die if it seemed like, you know, that was an issue, but also because as you make that consideration about social distancing, right, that is partly about like your parents' goals of care. How important is it to your parent, do you think, to minimize their risk of getting this infection? Are they willing to sacrifice spending time with people they love for that? You know, this is again a trade-off. And so the CDC's guidance is generally going to be about minimizing the risk of death. And that's important. But as we know, for older people, that's not necessarily the only priority. Pneumonia, for whatever it's worth, did used to be called the old man's friend. So not that I want anybody to get pneumonia, but I think it's just important to step back and ask ourselves these questions before jumping ahead to whatever seems to be the safest or least risk of death. So we're going to go into questions really quickly. Michelle Allen has decided she's able to do another bonus Saturday call this month. It's going to be on the 21st. And then on our next regularly scheduled Thursday call, I am going to have Linda Fodrini-Johnson join me. And that one we will do in the afternoon, 3 p.m. Pacific. Susan is asking, where are the self-care tools located? So we will share that in the replay. There, I think it's under like featured posts in the online community. And then if you go into the HOP library, the membership resources, which is where our replays are, there's another section that has the audios. So now let's go into questions and answers. And so again, this is not establishing, let me see, doctor-patient relationship between me or any of your parents. This is just education and advice, as I usually do. So, all right, let's go now to your questions. So who here had posted, so M. Franklin posted a question, and did you have to, or raise her hand, did you have to go? And actually, I see Dr. Nicole here. I'm wondering, maybe let me get Dr. Nicole on very quickly to see if she wants to add anything from what the experience has been like in Canada. Oh, and then Kim has to go. So we'll do you next, Kim. Hey, Dr. Nicole.
Hello. Hello. Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you.
Oh, great. Thanks. I'm so glad I was able to catch the call today. And I work at, for those who don't know me, I'm a geriatrician in Canada, and I work at a moderately sized community hospital in Ontario. So we're sort of in the southwest of Canada. So I guess it would be like we're not too far from Detroit and in Michigan. Mm-hmm. Detroit being in Michigan. Mm-hmm. American geography.
Yeah.
But Yeah, no, it's really interesting here. And actually, my clinic space is in a hospital, and it's just been converted into a community coronavirus screening site. So there are people coming in from the community getting screened and then going back out into the community.
So, have you had
So
a lot of frail older adults come down with it in Canada?
not too many. Honestly, the numbers are very small so far. In our region, there are two cases, and they're not in frail older adults, from what I know. But there it's starting. So I know, for example, there was a an oncologist in Hamilton, which is a nearby city, where they the oncologist actually tested positive for COVID after a trip to Hawaii, and so she worked, a lot of immunocompromised and frail people. So I think it's going to be, I think the flattening the curve, hopefully that'll happen, but for sure we're going to see things coming. We're going to see things trickling out. So I'm definitely encouraging people to avoid things that they don't have to go to. Try to make virtual contact instead of in-person contact. It's okay. And I think one thing older adults need to hear is that it's okay to say no. Or even, I think the children of older adults, like, it's okay, like you said in your presentation, it's okay to not make that visit. It's okay to take a little break from that, because it is for the greater good. And I think we feel a lot of guilt when we have to turn things down, and we think, oh, it's not that bad. But really, it's very sensible to make those decisions right now.
So
More.
Jamie is asking, does Canada have a shortage of test kits?
I have not heard that yet. So as far as I know, that's not a limiting factor. No, not so far. Not so far. But I think the problem here is going to be the if people do get ill, like there, and it's like that in the US too, is there's going to be a bottleneck in the hospital. There's only so many ICU beds. And if we have even an additional 5 or 10 people that need an ICU bed, that's going to be very challenging to meet.
Which
So
is why we're going to try to flatten the curve. Okay, I want to try to get Kim's question because she said she had to go and meet her brother. But thank you so much, Dr. Nicole.
thank you.
Okay, so Kim, all right, you asked a great question. Let me get you on.
Yes, because
Okay.
we are, my mom is in the I wish I would get coronavirus so she could go be with her husband in heaven.
Okay. All right. Well, I think I think you're bringing up an important point, which is that there are some older adults who feel like they are ready to go, right? And this is why it's important to have considered, that question of, where is your parents' preferred place to die, and how do they kind of feel about it right now, right? Because some of them are kind of, I don't know that I'd say happy, but willing to take an exit when one presents itself, right? So that's a good point that if any of you are kind of going back and forth with your parents about like how many precautions they should take, it's important to have that sense of like, well, what are their concerns and fears about coronavirus, right? How do they feel about it? Because maybe for you're thinking, oh my God, what if you got it, you died? And maybe they're thinking, that wouldn't be so bad,
Yes, and in fact, my brother lives in Denver, and I asked him and my mom, what are we going to do? Do you want to visit? And my brother said, Mom, it's up to you. And she said, I want you to come visit. I don't care if you would get contract the coronavirus on the plane or whatever. I'm ready for you to come. But he did say that every single person that he saw on the plane had their own wipes, hand sanitizer, and it was like they were all cleaning their seats. And so people are
Which,
taking it seriously.
yeah, which they should. I mean, they're still sitting very close to each other, so I think we don't yet know how effective that is. So a couple of things. So first of all, it's one thing for your mom to say, I'm not worried about my getting it. Even if she says, I'm not worried about, my son getting it, he gets to decide, right? What kinds of precautions he wants to take. And so yes, like I would encourage all of you to like, it's reasonable to say no to something that your parent wants if it doesn't feel right for you, or if you feel like it involves too much sacrifice for
Right.
your own health or your own risk. Now, what you mentioned in your question in the group was that your mom has a pulse requesting no intervention. So she's option three, comfort care only, right?
Yes.
Okay. So is it realistic to have a prescription for a low-dose sedative to help in instance of anxiety and panic? So are you thinking there that she might get coronavirus and be sick and then get very anxious and panic about it?
Yes, because she did that when my mom's husband was starting to die. She's, mm-hmm. you know, he had a pulse as well, and mm-hmm. she started backpedaling for him.
Right, right.
He wasn't able to respond. And I think, you know, when it comes down to it, there's a point where you start to panic and go, I'm not sure I want to do this.
Yeah, yeah. No, no. I mean, it's a very valid point to bring up. And it's something that I've been trying to research and find out more about, because I thought, well, all these older people that I know, and it's not a huge proportion, but the ones who are, you know, option two or three, right? Selective treatment or mm-hmm. comfort care. It's like if they get coronavirus and they wanted to die at home, right? If they had said, well, if I get it, like, you know, I'm not horrified at the thought of dying. If that's what's in store for me, I would just like to be home and comfortable. You know, would we be able to get them hospice, right? You know,
right.
like quickly, because that's the ideal solution.
Yes.
Is to get that supportive system where they can provide medications, where they can attend to the fears that come up. And I think right now it's really like, it's unknown, like how responsive hospice will be able to be.
Yes.
And
with my
how quickly.
Mom's husband, it took 48 hours to get hospice in. And mm-hmm. during that time, my mom was almost hysterical.
Right.
And
yeah.
it was her. It wasn't my mom's husband was pretty much comatose at that time.
Right. So to answer your question, I think it's not unreasonable to see. So first of all, what I would say is I think it would be something to bring up to your mom's physician.
Okay.
Right. So again, anticipatory planning for coronavirus. You mm-hmm. know, I want to talk about like how we might handle it if my mom did get it. Right.
Okay.
Like her goal, you know, she does not want to delay her death. You know, she says she would, you know, like you can frame it the way you said. She's waiting to get it. I don't know if she'd welcome it. But, you know, you could say her goals are, you know, comfort and not delaying death. But I want to make sure that if she were quite sick, like we would be able to treat any anxiety or symptoms or shortness of breath fairly quickly. Can you talk to me about how we might do that?
Okay.
And yes, ideally you would get hospice and they would prescribe the medications. But you could also see, like, would the provider be comfortable giving you some medication to have on hand?
You yeah, know, even if it was just a small...
In case she's quite sick, and that provider may or may not be willing. I will also say that although I think hospitals can be a crummy place to be, I am assuming that hospitals that have a lot of coronavirus going on will have comfort care, what we used to call comfort care rooms, mm-hmm. Available inpatient to transition people who did not want to go to the intensive care unit.
Yeah.
So... I think for many people, if they were asked, you know, if you were going to be on hospice comfort care, would you rather be home or in a hospital room? I think a lot of people would rather be home.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, we have to take what we're able to get, right?
Right.
So in terms of thinking of a plan for your mom, it might be, you know, bringing it up to the provider to see what the provider suggests.
Okay.
Finding out, you could even preemptively like check in with, you know, hospices around you. They won't know how quickly they'll be able to take people until it kind of starts happening, right?
You
know?
Right.
And nobody knows right now, like, how much of a surge there might be. So this kind of relates to a question. So, Kim, do you have anything more?
No, that's great. Thank you.
Okay. All right.
She's in palliative care, so I will also bring that up to the nurse. And
right.
You would know exactly what's going on with hospice.
Yeah, so she's already connected into palliative care, which is actually mm-hmm. really good.
Yeah, that was thanks to y'all.
Oh, yeah. Well, okay.
Thank you very much.
Okay, so I want to do kind of related to this Carolyn's question. Carolyn's not here, though. Because Carolyn asked kind of a what I thought was a related question, which is, if a frail older person gets sick from COVID-19, what is that progression likely to look like? What is the timeline likely to be? What choices would likely need to be made along the way? Dr. K had mentioned the respiratory choice. What does it look like if somebody opts for a respirator, and what does it look like if they don't? Oh, and Mary says she has to go. Okay, Mary, let me do you next, right after this. So we kind of went over this when I was going through my lesson part of today's call. But again, what it's likely to look like, so initially it might be like the flu, fever, sore throat, cough. And then what we would be most worried about would be either pneumonia, so short of breath, coughing, or possibly older adults can just get kind of, you know, almost sort of septic looking. So sepsis is overwhelming infection, usually due to bacteria, but you can get something similar due to viruses. And what happens with that is people tend to get very tired because their blood pressure gets low. Now, that is not very uncomfortable. They will just be kind of out of it. They might also be kind of short of breath. So the choices to make are, I think, you know, for most of you, unless you've made a very intentional decision that you're going to focus on comfort care and no hospital, you will be going to the hospital. That's a way to get some additional support, you know, like a little oxygen. The jury is kind of out on how much oxygen in the nose helps when people have a very severe pneumonia, but they can also get, what can be very important is medication for pain and for shortness of breath. So in people who are on hospice or comfort care, morphine does help with shortness of breath and can relieve some of that. The other things that they often do on hospice for severe shortness of breath are fans in the face. And again, you know, the decision, so a certain number of people have deteriorated for their lung function fairly quickly in the hospital. So it would be good to go into the hospital having a sense of whether you'd be willing to have intubation or not. It's not unreasonable to say a trial of intubation. It's just that if they keep getting worse, they may not get off of it, right? So I would say those are kind of, you know, if somebody opts for the ventilator, I mean, they put a tube in the throat, the person has to be sedated to be on the machine. And then because they will be infectious like this, everyone will have to wear a ton of gowns and extra material to be near them. So I think even in best case scenarios, the intensive care unit often doesn't feel like a very friendly environment to me. But when people are under infection precautions, I mean, everybody around them is gowned up. Now, if your parents said, I want to die at home, you know, you have to ask yourself, like, how do I feel about that? Or being in that space where there's coronavirus around, you are going to be exposing yourself to it probably, unless you're able to get yourself gowned up like crazy. And maybe you don't want to expose yourself that way. I mean, again, most people who are younger, healthier, don't get critically ill, but a small proportion do. So I think it's, you know, it's not an easy decision to make, but those would be some of the considerations. Okay, Mary, let me get you, let's talk about your situation before you have to go. Yours was not particularly about coronavirus, but still really interesting and important. Are you there?
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Hi.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. So your question, I guess I'm going to do Amy's question in a moment, because you said I have the same question. So Amy had asked, she's worried about her mother living in an independent living facility with the coronavirus, right? And so you said, I have the same question with your brother-in-law in acute care rehab, and the kids are planning for what's next, going home or to assisted living. Should his family get a thorough look at what it would take to get him cared for at home? All right, and to just like give everybody a snapshot of the backstory, your sister has, you've been concerned about your sister's cognitive abilities for at least a few months.
Correct.
Because you see a lot of signs that she's slipping. She has been caring for your brother-in-law, and he was recently hospitalized after a fall. He had had a stroke. And before he was hospitalized for his fall, what was his diagnosis again?
He had a stroke 12 years ago, and That's basically it. He just was continuing to decline after that stroke.
So she's been taking care of him post-stroke, and he did have some cognitive deficits before this recent hospitalization, or he didn't?
He did, but according to the children, he seems the same as far as how he speaks and communicates, and he's obviously not the same physically.
Okay, but I guess what I'm getting at is your sister, it sounds like for a while, had been making kind of his medical decisions?
Right. I mean, she's in the position to do that, and
because he was disabled.
Right.
And she was the trustee for their trust.
Correct.
So now, as you see her declining, you and your nephews have been concerned about her ability to manage her husband's care.
Right.
Appropriately, and also that she needs help. And now, most recently, he was hospitalized after a fall and seems to have had another stroke. And correct. You have been working with your nephews and an elder care attorney to see if you can get her removed as trustee, and kind of, I guess it's both about taking over the care of your brother-in-law and also her.
Right.
Helping her. Okay.
Correct.
So what would be a question you have for me today? Because there are so many pieces there that I want you to give me something to get started with.
Well, if... I've obviously don't live in the same state. And mm-hmm. so it's what kinds of professionals are the best people to help navigate the system in the areas of health and medical decisions. And then we have kind of a separate decision with where to live after he's discharged. And mm-hmm. then financial is kind of underway with seeing the elder care attorney and her possibly resigning the trust, but right. then discovered that the insurance has been, since they retired, has been what they call commercial primary and Medicare partial, mm-hmm. which is going to affect, if they move and go somewhere else, it's going to probably affect, at least short term, the coverage that they get, I guess.
And right.
Okay. I wouldn't know who to ask or tell them who to ask.
Yeah. Well, let's come to the insurance later. I mean, it sounds like, you know, in the short term. So was your brother-in-law able to make any of his medical decisions before this latest hospitalization or no?
No.
No. Okay. So he's been considered disabled and incapacitated for a while.
Right.
Okay. So on one hand, there's sort of like who is making the decision right now about his discharge from acute care rehab?
Technically on paper, it would still be my sister, but the children have stepped in, both the two that live there near
yeah.
her.
So,
stepped in.
Yeah, and I think you mentioned in the group that the hospital staff are talking to your nephews.
Correct.
And you were sort of asking about that. So this is a fuzzy gray area, right?
Mm-hmm.
Often the healthcare professionals who are involved, so sometimes they talk to whichever family member is talking to them and seems capable. And sometimes they, on their own, sort of worry a little bit about an older spouse who seems not quite with it.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes that worry is justified and sometimes it's ageism, right?
Right.
Know? Sometimes mm-hmm. it's just like that older spouse didn't have their hearing aids and couldn't hear them well. Mm-hmm. And then they were dismissed as like not the right person to make decisions inappropriately. Mm-hmm. So you're right that ideally they would be very kind of diligent and systematic, but often they're not. So have they, in rehab, who have they been turning to? Your sister more or your nephews more?
Probably the nephew that's been visiting most. And he's the second brother. He's mm-hmm. not the one in line for the power of attorney, or the trustee. But they're considering the older brother and him sharing it because he's now much more interested in the healthcare proxy part of things, I think.
Okay, yeah. So, yes, we should talk about that for a moment, too. So in terms of your brother-in-law, have your nephews brought up to the people in rehab their concerns about their mother?
No. Okay. I think only the older brother has, at least in my conversations with him, I asked him if he agreed with me that she was slipping, and he said yes. So, but okay. Yeah.
So if your family is in agreement that she's slipping, then, you know, like one question is how to sort of direct your brother-in-law to the right next care. Mm-hmm. And that's partly going to depend on to what extent you have to kind of oppose your sister, right? So if she's kind of going along with whatever her kids say, right? Mm-hmm. Then you can kind of, you know, influence her and kind of push it along, especially if the facility is listening to your nephews, you know, and move it along for now. Whereas mm-hmm. if she's having an actual like disagreement with her children, that's when sometimes it becomes more necessary to bring it to the attention of the facility that you think that the technical decision maker is impaired and have grave concerns about it. Okay. Because if she's impaired and making poor choices, that is potentially like reportable to Adult Protective Services, right?
Right.
For the caregiver being unable to discharge their responsibility. But it's better to not have to like bring that conflict to a head if necessary. So I would say for now, your family should, you know, try to nudge things to get your brother-in-law in a reasonably safe spot for now, while they still like figure out how to manage your sister's kind of undiagnosed incapacities. In terms of whether he should go home or to assisted living, I mean, as you brought up, it's sort of like, where will he get the care and services that he needs? If your sister has been disabled like this for months, it's likely to continue, right?
Right.
More like years. Yeah. So, you know, there are like bigger questions about what's your brother-in-law's preference for where he would want care? If he could choose, if money were no option, and then what's financially feasible, right? But presumably somebody is going to have to be there providing care to either both of them if they stay together, or each of them separately, because he definitely needs care. Mm-hmm. Your sister-in-law is no longer able to oversee it or provide it. And she is going to need like some amount of care and supervision as well, both short-term and probably in the longer term. So in terms of who would navigate you through this, I mean, again, I think a really good geriatric care manager would be your best bet. And the question is just finding one who's really good. In terms of your nephew's sharing power of attorney, so experts generally don't recommend that. It tends to cause problems. Mm-hmm. So the options are, I think the eldest one right now is the successor proxy, right?
Correct.
Okay. So first of all, the one who is the power of attorney can give permission to providers to talk to and work with his sibling, right? Okay. So without giving that up, mm-hmm. he can give permission, you know, and kind of relay. So that often is going to be possible. You have to just like make sure it works for the facility. Facilities in general want to talk to just one family member. It's not good for them to be talking to multiple ones. So it's a little bit like, who's the ultimately responsible and what can that person delegate to someone else, you know, without giving up their legal role? He could, I think it depends on how the power of attorney is written, but I think usually the agent doesn't have the right to designate somebody else. Sometimes the way it's drafted is there's like somebody who's first, or if they can't serve or don't want to, it goes to the second one, right? So there uh-huh. would also be the question of like, how technically could it be passed on to one of his siblings if the oldest one wanted to give it to somebody else? But sharing it legally tends to cause problems.
Okay.
Now, I think it's good to have everyone involved, right? You know, because not letting everybody involved also causes problems.
Right.
But there are cases where when an older person has named both children to act jointly, when mm-hmm. they get into conflicts, it creates huge problems.
Okay.
So I would discourage that particular kind. And then, I think there's going to be this you know, for your nephews, this process of systematically working through the issues one at a time. And I would encourage them, you know, kind of like in the organization thing, like pick one or two things every month, right? Mm-hmm. And ask yourself what can be put off for right now. I mean, a lot of these things do interconnect, right? So the housing choices you make depend on the finances that are available, and like the kind of care you can get depends on what, you know, benefits you're eligible for depending on your insurance or, you know, whatever you have signed up for. But yeah, it's not going to be easy to figure out where they should live, but yeah. And until your sister is definitely declared incapacitated and someone else is allowed to make decisions for her, that's going to be challenging for your family too.
Yeah.
But your brother-in-law, as you said, is a vulnerable, disabled person. And I think you and your family are taking the right steps in sort of recognizing that this is, you know, I don't think your sister is being intentionally neglectful, right? But it counts.
Well, you know,
she can't meet his needs.
Right.
And what does she think?
She thinks she's doing a great job.
Yeah.
And this is what she really wants to do.
Yes. So. Well, my heart goes out to her, you know. So as you know, her insight is impaired.
Right.
She can't see all these things that the rest of you can see. But I want to remind you again that you probably won't be able to explain it to her that she's not able to do it, you mm-hmm. know. So you can acknowledge that desire of hers, right? You've worked so hard to take care of him. I can see it's really important to you, mm-hmm. right? Let's find a way for you to keep taking care of him, and we're going to help you in these other ways because we have to.
Yeah.
You know, but I would, you know, if your nephews were here, I would say, don't expect your mom to understand this. It's pointless to keep trying to explain and show her, look how you weren't doing it well enough. This is why we have to do it. If she has that need to feel like she's helping and taking care, like how can you still tend to that need, right? And still step in and do what's necessary for the health and well-being of her spouse.
Right. I think that's good direction.
Yeah. So remind them to not try to explain to their mom.
I don't think that'll be obvious to them, but I will.
Well,
definitely
you never know. Like a lot of people are like, well, listen, this is why we had to do this, you know?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah,
as
say
you said,
too much.
If she thinks she's doing it okay and she wanted to, mm-hmm. you know, how can we give empathy to that? Okay.
Yeah. That sounds great. Thank
Keep
you so
us
much.
Posted. Okay.
We will.
All right. Who wants to go? Did anyone? Oh, let me see. There was a question here. Does anyone else have a question next? Otherwise, I'll do a few of the others that came up. Okay. I'm going to do, in that case, Amy. Is Amy here? Amy's here. Oh, she is here. Here we go. Amy, let me put you up. You asked a good question. Are you there, Amy? All right. You have to unmute yourself. I'll start reading your question while we see if you'll get unmuted. So what you said is, with the looming threat of coronavirus, I'm worried about my mother living in an independent living facility. The stories coming out of the nursing home in Washington are heartbreaking. I'm wondering if I should have her live at my home until the imminent threat is over. The problem is that our house is really not set up to accommodate her. Am I jumping the gun or thinking the worst? Okay, so Amy, I was wondering if you could remind me, first of all, which part of the country do you live in and what your mother's health situation is like? I don't know if you are able to say in the chat or to unmute yourself. It's possible that Amy is not listening super closely right this moment. I know people sometimes are on while they also have to do something else. So we'll see if Amy is able to weigh in on that. But yeah, I think this is a legitimate thing to think about. And so to come back to what I shared before and how I would encourage you to think through this. So first of all, I think there are going to be two questions. So one is, you know, do you move a parent out to reduce their, you know, before there's an outbreak at the facility, right? So first of all, I don't know that I would really have them move if there's not a lot of coronavirus in your local area yet. But if it seems like it's starting to emerge, and when there are first few cases, that's usually the tip of the iceberg, and then like tons of stuff comes up, then you might be wondering, well, so do I move them before there's an outbreak in their facility? And your reasoning there might be, I guess I would sort of like be interested in like, what is Amy hoping to accomplish? So one question is, where is your parent less likely to get infected? And is that in your home or is that in the facility? And I think right now, nobody really knows. One will depend on how the facility is being run. It will also depend on what's going on in your household, right? Like who's coming in and out of your household. Our guess is that school children, especially like, you know, high schoolers, and also younger ones, you know, will, like, they go and spend time with a lot of other young people and probably pass germs along with themselves. And then they come into the house, and that's probably going to be a source of exposure or risk for older adults. Same goes for grandchildren, right? So whereas in your house, if it's just you and your spouse and you work from home, you know, you're probably not creating a lot of exposure. So you should think about sort of how much exposure you think there's going to be in your home compared to the facility. Facilities are going to be probably pretty diligent and organized about trying to reduce it. The next question is, you know, if there's an outbreak in the facility or in the area. And again, I think, you know, you could think about it two ways. One, if there's an outbreak, you could think, well, if I bring them home, could I prevent them from getting sick from the outbreak? Maybe, we don't know. Then I guess the other question would be if you thought your parent would prefer to be, you know, sick in your home. But again, if they're sick in your home, you're exposed to it, right? And do you want to go through that? And then the next thing to consider is just how long would you have them in your home, right? So again, we are hoping to flatten the curve, which is going to be better for us as a society, and means we might be dealing with this for much longer. Another question is, you know, is it about bringing them home just for a few weeks, just to make sure you get some quality time with them while you can, because none of us know, you know, what the future will hold. And that's not unreasonable too. But again, if your home is not set up to accommodate her, like how comfortable will she be? How easy will it be to meet her needs? How much strain is it going to be for you? So, you know, there's no exact answers to any of this, but those would be some of the things that I would be thinking about. I would also encourage everyone to think about how you can sort of set up, you know, if you don't already have your parents set up to FaceTime or to kind of virtually connect with family, you know, is that a possibility that you could look into? Actually, I don't know if she is going to be able to talk, but I see that we have H here with us right now, whose father got the tablet, the Jerry Joy Care Coach tablet. But that is a device that both provides some companionship, but can also show pictures of family. So I kind of think about, you know, is that going to be a way to counter the social isolation that some older adults might experience as we go through this social distancing? So next question I wanted to do is Kathy's question. And actually, I don't know if Kathy is here, but I saw that Jamie was here. She may have had to leave. Okay, I'm going to do Kathy's question. Kathy asked a really good question. And then after, let's see, who else is here? Yeah. I think that might be the last question. So Kathy's question was, what should I do with my parents who live in their home? Mom has dementia, dad is her caregiver. I've explained to them wash hands for two happy birthdays, but I'm concerned they don't get it. I've asked them to stay home, but right afterwards they left the house to go for dinner. Dad still drives. I've cooked meals for them, but I'm very concerned they just don't get it. Any ideas? Yeah, I think this is definitely going to come up, right? Which is that your parent might be less careful than you think they should be, either because they're just making different decisions in terms of risk, or because there is a factor of, you know, cognitive slowing or maybe even some cognitive impairment that is keeping them from remembering or appreciating the situation the way the rest of you can. And so, you know, what can you do about it? And I think it's like anything else that we try to remind people to do. You know, first of all, getting a sense of like, what is their understanding of the situation? How do they see it? right? So I would ask, like, you know, what have they said about it? What are their concerns, fears, motivations when it comes to coronavirus? Is it that they really don't know and they're forgetting? Or is it just that they're like, eh, we've survived the flu sort of, you know, for 80 years already? So having that sense is going to be helpful. And then trying to figure out, you know, are there, if it's really about them forgetting, you know, are there simple little things you can do? Can you post reminders? Will they let you go and run errands for them? You know, seeing what you're able to do, and also kind of accepting that you're probably not going to be able to get them to do the things that are best for their health and their protection, right? So you can only do what you can do, which is bring it up, which is, again, I would say, being curious about how they see it, how they perceive it, coming back to, like, what are their goals and priorities, and can you frame your suggestions for what you're suggesting they do as a way to do that, you know? Like, would it be about something about helping to keep the grandkids safe, you know? Like, maybe it's not the time to emphasize how at risk they are and put it as, like, trying to keep, you know, their grandchildren or their community safe. You know, again, we have to think about, like, what are the motivators, the things that sound motivating to the older person? Because often, like, take care of yourself, you're at risk, is not something that older people particularly respond to. And then it's, you know, again, making your own kind of preparations for if one of them was to get sick, what would, you know, do we know what we would do, right? Having thought about that so that you're not trying to figure that out right in as things go along. And I feel like there was another question I was supposed to answer from Leslie B, and I don't see it on my list, but I just remembered it. Oh, you know, the thing didn't print properly. Hold on a sec. I'm going to look, but I just realized my printout is flawed. I see PJ's question, so hold on a sec, PJ. Let me get you too. So Leslie B's question, because I want to make sure I answer that, and then we're going to wrap this up pretty soon. There it is. Oh, she had asked, how do you prepare and plan when you are the caregiver in the event you become exposed or fall ill? Some people that we know, she's part of a daughterhood circle. Some of our members live with their elder, and some are not live-in primary caregivers. So I would say the answer there is to have a backup plan, right? Like, we should all be making kind of backup plans. So you know, who could step in to help out? So the crisis we should be planning for is, you know, have I thought about what we as a family would do if our older parent gets sick? And have we thought about what we as a family would do if the primary caregiver gets sick, whether that's you or somebody who's paid? So it would be like, who is the backup, right? Do you have a backup who could step in? Is that going to be another family member? If you have a paid caregiver, would you take some time off work for a while? Could you get somebody else to do it? Those would be my kind of thoughts right now. I mean, again, it's hard to predict, right? Because we don't know how many people are going to fall ill or how quickly. Okay, so PJ, let's maybe do your question last, and then we are going to wrap it up. So your question was, let's see. Okay, go ahead, PJ.
Hi there.
Hi. Yeah.
But, you know, I'm really ambivalent about this stuff. I have a difficult parent who doesn't want to be told anything. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they zip out into 4 o'clock traffic in the East Bay, 4:30. You know, it's mm-hmm. kind of nutty. But they are eating at restaurants every single day. And mm-hmm. if they, you know, they're 90 and 86, they want to believe it's not a big deal because they are on the, you know, they're on the Fox News crowd. And it just, it's very, it's kind of disheartening.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, I'm at the point where if she dies, you know, that's sort of up to her at this point, you know, of coronavirus or anything else, because she doesn't she's not cooperative, but I don't want her to, you know, hurt other people.
Yeah.
It's just a concern for parents who are stubborn.
Right. Well, and your mom is not just stubborn. Your mom, based on what you've said, is probably, you know, truly cognitively impaired.
Yeah, and I think she has a severe personality disorder too. So
right, and she's in this kind of gray area where she has impairments, but she's still kind of hanging in there and doing a lot of stuff independently, much of which you think is unsafe for her or for other people.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think especially for this epidemic, you know, we have to accept that some people are going to be doing, you know, are not going to be following all the precautions, are going to like sneeze and not cover their mouths, are going to go out when they shouldn't. I mean, this is part of why public health departments are taking steps like themselves saying, you know, no gatherings, no events, no large things, canceling things, right? Mm-hmm. I don't know that we're going to get to the point that Italy has gotten to, but, you know, in Italy, first they put a curfew at bars, you know, no bars open after 6 p.m. And they put in a rule that people had to stay a meter away from each other in there. And now they've just closed everything, right? They just closed everything. They're like, the grocery stores and pharmacies stay open and everybody else stay home.
Yep.
So I think all we can do is, you know, control our own behavior and encourage others to do the right thing. And, you know, I'm sure you've brought it up to your mom. And she might spread some coronavirus. She won't be the only person.
Right.
So you can just do what you can do. But I think, again, she may or may not be able to sort of engage in a conversation, like, you know. So if she were sick and had, you know, pneumonia, I assume she would want to go to the hospital. She generally has been getting medical care. And I don't know if you have a sense of whether she would want intensive care or not, because if she were sick enough to need it, she probably wouldn't be able to decide. They would turn to you.
Yeah.
Or whoever is her next of kin, either her next of kin or on her durable power of attorney for healthcare, whichever one she has.
Right.
You know, in most, in just about every state for a health emergency, doctors can turn to next of kin to make a decision. That's not true for finances, but it's true for healthcare. So they would ask you, right?
Right.
And how long to be on, you know, how long would you want to keep her on the vent? They may or may not ask. And so do you feel like you have the information you need to answer that question?
I do. She wants to feel like she's really still living. She doesn't want it. She says, I don't want to be drilling on my chin. You know, if I'm like that, don't, you know, pull the plug. I don't want to be alive. I have a pretty good sense, but she's not having a very good time in her life anyway.
Yeah.
I don't think it's a very big decision at this point to let her go if she were dying.
Well, so just, you know, having thought through that, and then otherwise, like, keep checking on her so that if she ends up being like, oh, I have a fever and sore throat, I don't feel so good,
mm-hmm.
you know, like, I think you don't live very close to her, but, you know, would somebody check in? Do you know, like, who you'd call to get her some help?
Yeah, the other
I
family.
I think that's all you can do.
Guy's a retired fireman EMT, so we've got something.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's when you're, these people are in la-la land and, you know,
I know.
And are difficult. It's a different deal.
I know. Yeah. And then, you know, keep taking care of yourself, of course, right?
Yep.
So your rest and your self-care so that if an emergency comes up for your mom, you're, you know, ready to step up and help her navigate through it. So that's
Do you think it's good? I mean, I'm 66. Is it, if I needed to get on a plane, is that a stupid idea right now? Is it better to drive down there? You know, I'm a 12-hour drive away.
Well, it would be a short plane ride. Right?
True.
So shorter is better.
Yeah.
I think you would have to take it case by case, right? It would kind of depend how much was going around in the area you were coming from, in the area you were going from. Like a 12-hour drive is usually like an hour, hour and a half plane flight.
Yep.
Who knows? Maybe they'll even have spaced out like seats by then, right? I mean, I don't know. I think, you know, I think again, like non-essential travel. But yeah, if your mom were very sick, that would be an essential trip. And then you would have to kind of like weigh the pros and cons of your available options, which is take a short trip or a drive. But, you know, a drive is very long too. I mean, 12-hour drive is not insignificant.
Yeah. So, okay. Listen,
okay.
Thank you so much.
All right. Yeah. Okay. All right, everybody. So we are going to wrap it up right now. I think I did all the questions that were submitted for me ahead of time. So I will post some related links. Jamie went. I think I answered Jamie's question, though. Jamie had sort of asked how long is the time frame? And the answer is right now that nobody knows. Too soon to tell. So we are going to be taking it, I think, right now it's really day by day, but I think, you know, a week at a time, I expect we'll know more within the next week or two. Nobody even knows whether this is going to fizzle out as the weather gets warmer, which is what influenza tends to do, or not. So just a lot of uncertainty right now. So it is stressful to live in times of uncertainty. And so that's why I want to encourage you all again to think about your rest and your self-care. We don't know what will happen to your parents, but and the public health authorities are, you know, making plans for worst case scenarios because that's their job. But at the same time, you know, given the number of people there were in China, I forget what the death toll was, but I actually thought the number of people who had gotten sick was less than I expected, given the number of people living in the area. So I'm crossing my fingers that it hopefully won't be as bad as it could be. And we need to take sensible precautions and do some sensible planning ahead. So with that, I'm going to wish you a good rest of your afternoon. Thank you so much for being here today and for your questions. Feel free to post your follow-up questions in the group as we go along, and we'll try to pay attention and help you work through this rapidly evolving situation. So thanks again, everybody. Talk to you soon. Take care. And with that, I'm going to wrap up this episode of Better Health While Aging. If you have any questions about something you heard in this episode, you can post it on the show notes page for the episode. I'll also be posting some links to some of the resources that I mentioned in the episode. To find the show notes, visit betterhealthwhileaging.net and click podcast in the main menu at the top. Last but not least, if you've been enjoying the podcast, don't forget to support us by subscribing on iTunes. And if you've already done that, please leave a rating and review. This makes it easier for others to discover our show in iTunes. And I would love for the many people who are interested in health or aging or family caregivers to be able to find it and give it a chance. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Dr. Leslie Kernison, and I'm looking forward to you joining us for future episodes.